end of the war, the German Kaiser goes into exile, marking the end of the era of German monarchy. A woman enters the lecture hall of the Faculty of Law and Political Science at Vienna University. The age of patriarchy is beginning its decline. Two brothers set up the world's first airline in France. The age of civil aviation is getting off the ground. The year is 1919.
How do you rebuild a company after losing a war? Is it even worth it? Bosch factories in France and the US were under compulsory administration as enemy assets, and Bosch patents in England were annulled. Nearly all his business partners in neutral nations had broken off contact. As deliveries abroad had ceased during the war years, local suppliers of ignition devices had sprung up in many countries and were now competition. Did the old trademark and the tried and trusted name still count for anything? And what were they associated with? A hated enemy or an esteemed producer of quality workmanship?
It was suggested that a potentially good way to put the Bosch name back on the world map would be with a new symbol, a new logo. The multi-talented Gottlob Honnold tried his hand as a graphic designer and came up with the magneto-armature within a circle, the new trademark and face of the company's future. Combined, for example, with lower prices, it would signal the company's return and its commitment to a fresh start.
I received a letter from a Frenchman who wanted to act as my sales agent. While working as a military driver, he had found that none of the replacement products could match my ignition systems. An invitation from Stockholm arrived, requesting the resumption of business after all. The Swedes found that what American Magneto supplied was of inferior quality, and their business methods were no better. But best of all, two representatives from Peugeot visited on behalf of the management to re-establish contact.
As early as the mid-1920s, the company had already achieved a broader international reach than before the war. Despite initially outdated production equipment, customs barriers and inflation that also wreaked havoc with the business after the war, Bosch pulled through.
The astronomically high war reparations demanded by the victorious powers brought the German economy to its knees. The ensuing devaluation of the national currency turned everyone into millionaires. Even beggars, lucky enough to get hold of one of the banknotes with 7, 8, or 9-digit values. But at the height of the crisis, such sums bought little more than half a loaf of bread. In 1924, before the currency reform, the Robert Bosch Stock Corporation's annual report noted sales of 18 quintillion, 990 quadrillion, 415 trillion, 323 billion, 717 million, 414,132 German marks and 77 pfennigs.
Foreign currencies were more stable and played an important part in reconstruction and the development of new product lines. There was still plenty of practical equipment to contribute to automotive engineering. Windshield wipers, indicators, servo-assisted brakes, and horns, dubbed Bosch horns, reached market readiness in relatively quick succession. A bicycle lamp was also put into production.
At the same time, the Bosch service centres, a franchise network of independent workshops supplying Bosch replacement parts, spread throughout Germany, enhancing the company's reputation for guaranteed quality and the best in customer care. For owners of all makes and classes of car, these outlets were often the first port of call when their vehicle electrics needed repairs, improvements, or replacement parts.
Now a very different kind of internal combustion engine began its rise to prominence. The first prototypes had been developed before the turn of the century, and now the power plant was moving from its niche position to centre stage in the machine age. Unlike its gasoline counterpart, it did not require the intake of a combustible air-fuel mixture. Instead, only air was initially drawn into the chamber. The air inside the cylinder was compressed to such an extent that temperatures of 700 to 900 degrees Celsius were created. Before the piston reached the top of the compression stroke, fuel was injected and finally dispersed. The high air temperature caused the mix to ignite, and no spark was required.
As a team, Robert Bosch and his executives were always prepared for every eventuality. That included the possibility that spark plugs might become largely redundant, because an engine that didn't need them was taking the world by storm. If so, the company would serve automakers with something else as indispensable as its tried and trusted ignition systems. And they soon realized what that something might be. The engines without ignition spark, named after their inventor Rudolf Diesel, would soon proliferate in a number of variations, with one, two, or more cylinders, and as small, large, or gigantic versions. After all, diesel engines were originally used mainly to drive agricultural machinery and ships.
Optimal diesel engine operation depends on an optimal supply of fuel, injected at the right moment, dispersed over the right period of time, and adapted to variations in engine speed. To achieve this, an accurate, reliable, durable, and sophisticated injection pump was needed.
Developing this pump and ensuring its adaptability to as many different engines as possible would occupy the Bosch engineers for the coming years. In 1927, the job was done. Characterized by Bosch's customary excellent quality, the company's new accessory product, as intrinsically essential as the spark plug, was ready for market. The diesel injection pump also marked a new string in the Bosch bow, the first non-electric product that would soon be manufactured in large quantities.
While in the process of rebuilding his international sales network, successfully expanding the product range, and fighting the legal suit over the use of the Bosch name in America, Robert Bosch was also engaged in a revolution.
It became apparent early on that America took to the manufacture of mass-produced goods with what I can only describe as a fervor, something which could only be matched by extraordinary effort.
Years before, the Ford Motor Company in Michigan had introduced assembly line production. Every step of a job, every action, every movement was optimized to save time. As many details and interfaces as possible were designed with standardization in mind. The principle behind managing workflows became known as rationalization, Taylorism, or scientific management. This allowed employees to work much faster and much more efficiently. The result was an increase in unit output at lower prices. The world's factories were ushering in the age of mass production.
Ford has performed a great service to humanity by making the motor car available in huge numbers.
The unstoppable phenomenon that was Taylorism soon meant that much of what had previously been manufactured manually was now produced by machine and on the assembly line, even at Bosch. Those who missed the boat were ultimately doomed to sink. Notably, the workforce regarded these changes with suspicion. At first, the trade unions rejected rationalization altogether. Robert Bosch's dedication to ensuring that his people earned decent wages and worked in conditions that in no way jeopardised their health was still unflagging. Consequently, opposition within the company remained limited.
After the major rationalisation measures had been implemented and everything was ready for mass production, in 1926 a severe crisis struck German car manufacturing. Those in the industry believed that the root of the problem was political. Both purchasing and owning a car were prohibitively taxed.
The crisis dealt a massive blow to the Robert Bosch Stock Corporation. Despite reduced working hours and stockpiling, the workforce shrank rapidly from 13,000 to 8,000. Executives were not exempt from the cuts. Of the former 11 board members, only three remained, together with three deputies. Robert Bosch himself retired from active service, but remained available to the new management as an advisor.
In his new role, Bosch was increasingly preoccupied with one subject that had frequently given him pause for thought in the past: the flash in the pan. Considering the size that his company had now reached, this concern took on new dimensions.
We ourselves are trying to move away from automotive work, if we can, or, to be more precise, to add more strings to our bow.
The crisis had made clear the need to diversify with products devoted to more than one industry, and the solution was right at hand. Some of the company's manufacturing processes were already carried out using tools powered by electric motors. Why not put the Bosch stamp on this segment and expand it?
The decision was taken in 1927. A few years later, the first machines of this kind were ready to go into production and be unveiled to the public. Electric drills and sanders, screwdrivers, riveters, hammer drills, polishers, engravers, and electric metal shears.
At first, these electric tools were welcomed predominantly by large businesses in the machinery, lumber and construction industries, as well as by shipyards and aircraft manufacturers. As the engineers continued to expand the range of products, however, the tools soon made the jump to household use. Bosch made radios, gramophones, film projectors and refrigerators. The company had successfully moved into new fields of activity.
But once again, the pleasure at this triumph was not unclouded. Robert Bosch was 76 years old when he converted the stock corporation into a close corporation or limited liability company. After buying back all the stock from his partners, he was once again the sole proprietor of his business. A number of reasons prompted this move. One was to preserve his life's work for his family, and thus, hopefully, to protect it from possible interference by the state. Once again, things had changed dramatically. Politically, Germany was now a dictatorship, and the Bosch factories were of tremendous strategic interest to the members of the new ruling class. Plus, these people had the power to penetrate the very heart of the company, which is exactly what they did.
At first, Robert Bosch could do little more than look on. Adolf Hitler's appointment as Reichskanzler came as a shock. Sounding an inevitable death knell to Bosch's efforts towards reconciliation with France, it was soon followed by the demise of many social and political activities. The feelings of enmity between the two countries hadn't dissipated since the end of the First World War. Nationalism and feelings of revenge were to colour relations for some time to come. But such conditions could not be allowed to prevail. Thanks to his financial support and personal dedication to the cause of rapprochement, Robert Bosch proved a courageous, far-sighted liberal. He held discussions with members of the political elite in the hope of securing lasting peace in Europe. He was convinced that the surest way to achieve this was to strive for the opening and economic integration of markets, which remained closed behind national frontiers. His idea was to turn Europe into a single economic bloc without customs barriers. In such an environment, countries would be obliged to look for solutions based on agreement, rather than turning to arms.
These early ideas of a united Europe were very much ahead of their time. So much so that for years they would seem a distant dream.